Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 198 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have three cases today. First case is from the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District, Reinhart versus Loving. The second is from the Supreme Court of the United States, Coinbase Inc. versus Suski. And that's the second time it's been at the Supreme Court. We'll talk about that.
This particular case or Coinbase?
Coinbase, but similar case.
Similar case. Yep. Yeah. Last year they had a different issue. Yeah. Same party.
Same party. So, but Coinbase, we'll talk about that when we get there. And then the third case is from the Illinois Supreme Court, Andrew W. Levenfeld and Associates Limited versus O'Brien, has to do with attorney's fees. So an interesting
case. We talked about it when it was in the appellate court.
We did. And I think, was this the case that was argued at the Northern Illinois University, Pat?
Yep, we'll talk about that too.
And Justice Overstreet at the Appellate Lawyers Association was talking about the audience there and that case, so we'll get into that. Turning to our first case, can an arbitration clause apply to conduct that occurred before it was entered? That is one of the questions to be answered when the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District, decides Reinhart versus Loving. The plaintiff approached the defendants to assist him in handling his IRA on March 6, 2020, and then began the process of moving much of his money to the defendants. The agreement included an arbitration clause, was executed on March 31st, 2020. The plaintiff sued the defendants for advice related to conduct before the execution of the agreement, but the arbitration clause covers any dispute between the parties with no temporal limitation. The circuit court denied the motion to compel arbitration. Defendants appealed. Pat, tell us about this case.
Well, the first thing I want to say is mea culpa. I posted the case, and when it got, because I've been taking full advantage of the scheduling function on LinkedIn, and there has been a tidal wave, frankly, of decisions recently, which has caused me to have to post a whole lot more than I have otherwise. I'm up to three a day, which is an embarrassing sum. Sometimes four and five, but most days three right now, because there's been so much that's been coming out. I missed this decision, and it's been, I will say that, combined with the fact that the appellate court has been issuing decisions far faster than earlier, than previously. I mean, it used to be the second district was the rocket docket. They may be the slow people now with how fast some of the other districts are getting opinions out. We're going to talk about one of the predictions sure to go wrong, the Schwartz versus Sinav case, a tidy 56-page opinion gets issued in less than a month. I don't think they got extra staff. I know they didn't get extra justices. They are pumping out opinions. I don't know why that is happening, but there has been, in my observation, anecdotal to be sure, a substantial increase in the pace with which opinions are coming out. Maybe I am wrong, but that is what I am observing. So we already know the outcome of this case, so we won't be predicting it. But it was posted. We listened to it. It would be, even the black box would find that to be unfair, as it is always deferential to those that program the black box. The black box is Dan and I. It's always partial to us. So take our rankings, our standings with a dose of salt. But this one's even too much for the black box. The bottom line is this, and there's some interesting issues in this case. So if you have an arbitration issue, I commend it to you. So the first thing is, what is the scope of the review? So there are two parties that were challenging this denial of the arbitration, the motion to compel arbitration. And one of the parties argued some of the merits, and the court said, we aren't going to touch that because we don't have jurisdiction over that. The only thing we have jurisdiction over under Rule 307A are the issues related to, or is the issue related to compelling arbitration? The denial of the motion to dismiss on the merits is not reviewable under that rule. In fact, under Illinois law, it's not reviewable at all, except maybe on a 308 appeal. But that would be a certification of a question, which wasn't obviously an issue here. So it's not reviewable. So we're not looking at that. You make all these arguments about the merits. We're not touching that. The only thing we're touching is the issue of the motion to compel arbitration. So on the issue to compel arbitration, the appellate court reversed and held that they needed to compel arbitration. The trial court found that there was an ambiguity in the language. You may remember March of 2020, and I think all of us probably will. At the beginning of the month, this fellow, the plaintiff, wanted to move his money. It takes a while to move the money. And in the interregnum, a little something happened that caused the markets to go to hell in a handbasket. Namely, the shutdown or the government shutdown orders that led to the markets tumbling during that month and succeeding. And so, by the time it got moved, because of the time it took to do that, to liquidate the funds and move the money from one brokerage house to the another, he lost a whole bunch of dough. That if he had held it where it was at and kept it where it was at, yeah, he would have made some losses, but he probably would have gotten them back. But by liquidating them, they went from paper losses to real losses, which the real losses are what you're trying to avoid. No one really wants paper losses, but they're sure better than real losses, which this guy took, and then he sued his brokers because I don't know. I can't imagine what his theory is of liability, but that's not the interesting part of this case. In fact, it's not the case at all. The issue is this arbitration clause. The arbitration clause says any dispute between us. So the trial court found that provision to be ambiguous as to whether it covered pre-contract conduct folded into the arbitration. And neither party argued ambiguity. Obviously, the defendants didn't argue ambiguity. The plaintiff didn't argue ambiguity. He just said it can't possibly mean any dispute. And they pull out little bits of it, and they argue this. And the court goes, no, that's not how this works. Any means any. It means ones that predate you. No, predates the execution of the agreement. It covers it. The issue they had a dispute over also was whether the arbitration clause contained a delegation provision, that the arbitrability issue was delegated to the arbitrators, the arbitrator, as the case may be. And the court said, no, that it's not clear the nature of the contract that was formed, as is usually the case, is vested with the circuit court, unless there is a very clear delegation of arbitrability to the arbitrator, which didn't exist here. There have been, I talk about it at least in part of my column this week in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin, numerous cases about arbitration on a range of issues. We're going to talk about another arbitration case of a similar variety in terms of whether the contract covers something else. You know, this is a subsequent activity as opposed to a prior activity, but the same kind of idea. What is the temporal scope of the arbitration clause? So these issues are burgeoning as fights over arbitration continue. An interesting case. I commend it to you if you have arbitration issues to deal with. It will lead you down a rabbit hole of a whole bunch of other stuff. That's Reinhardt versus Loving. Dan, thoughts?
Pat, yeah, a lot of stuff you've already discussed. I think it's interesting here. I mean, just from a general contracting standpoint, you would think, you know, breach or other issues, it would be for things that were part of the contract, right? If any means any, just think of some of the relationships. You may have had a relationship with, say, AT&T. They had your home phone, and then now you've got internet or something else. So raises this interesting issues, I think, in terms of that temporal question, and we'll see how the court handles it. Other thing, I think that we've done a lot of nursing home cases. We've done a lot of these arbitration cases. Like I said, the next case in segments arbitration provisions. As a AAA arbitrator, it's amazing to me how many varieties of the standard provisions, or there is no real standard template provisions. it's amazing that we as lawyers haven't, you know, maybe AI can do some of this and fix some of this, because these things, it's amazing that you're sending the stuff to neutrals, and yet there's so many questions, whether something's been delegated to the arbitrator, what it applies to, what kinds of disputes, and
one wonders why hasn't there been an ISO of arbitration? You know, ISO is the insurance services organization that drafts policies to which insurance companies subscribe and they can use the forms. I don't know why there hasn't been a standardization of these things.
You know, it's an interesting point, because all the JAMS and Indispute and AAA and Arias, they all have template provisions, but it doesn't seem that, like ISO policies, that they're being used. They're just people draft these things, and a lot of it's just boilerplate.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really kind of amazing. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back and talk about Coinbase Inc. versus Suskie.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment 2 of episode 198 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And when you agree to arbitrate, you usually do not sign up to litigate for 3 years first, with a stop along the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. But that is what has happened in Coinbase Inc. versus Suskie. Yes, Coinbase again. They really like arbitration, and they are pressing on delegation again, like they did the last term in Coinbase versus Bielski. And the court held that, quote, a district court must stay its proceedings while an interlocutory appeal on the question of arbitrability is ongoing, end quote. In this recently argued case, the question presented is, quote, when parties enter into an arbitration agreement with a delegation clause, does an arbitrator or a court decide whether the arbitration agreement is narrowed by a later contract that is silent as to arbitration and delegation, end quote. That's clear as day. From Oye, the facts are, quote, in June 2021, Coinbase, an online cryptocurrency exchange, launched Dogecoin sweepstakes that required participants to opt into, quote, official rules, end quote, with a form selection clause stipulating exclusive jurisdiction in California courts for related disputes. Respondent David Suskie and three other users who had agreed to the, quote, Coinbase user agreement, end quote, containing an arbitration provision when they created their accounts, entered the sweepstakes. Subsequently, they filed a lawsuit against Coinbase and Martin Kane Inc., the company engaged by Coinbase for the sweepstakes management, alleging violations of California's false advertising law, unfair competition law, and the Consumer Legal Remedies Act. Coinbase sought to compel arbitration based on the user agreement, but the district court denied Coinbase's motion, interpreting the contractual documents to conclude that the sweepstakes official rules with the form selection clause took precedence over the user agreement's arbitration clause. On appeal, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirmed, concluding that the dispute should be resolved within the California court system as per the official rules of the sweepstakes, not through arbitration as Coinbase had sought. End quote. Dan, tell us about the case.
Sure, Pat. And as we talked about just in the conclusion of the last segment, here we are. We got provisions and contracts and things that don't necessarily work together. You would think in this case that subsequent agreements would be usually there's a provision, I think, in some, you know, a lot of these things, but these sweepstakes are becoming more and more prevalent. I think I've had clients that have asked for these, and there's all kinds of issues that come into play. Sweepstakes has its own set of rules and formatting and all that stuff. If you issue a prize over a certain amount in Florida and New York and some other places, you may have to get a bond. There's all kinds of rules about whether you have to pay to play, how you can do sweepstakes, all these rules, 50 states. And so in this case, again, the contract was silent, the sweepstakes agreement that you agreed to. These are all click-based, by the way. And it's Dogecoin, but I don't really know what Dogecoin is as opposed to Bitcoin or anything else. It's a form of cryptocurrency is all I know. And
that's what I know.
Somebody was going to win some huge bank of Dogecoin. So in any event, one of the things that I think we should say at the outset, Pat, is that this oral argument, we've talked about how long the court goes these days with oral arguments. This one in February was 42 minutes. I mean, it weighed in at not even an hour, which oftentimes kind of hints that either the justices just don't have a ton of questions or there's just not enough meat on the bone to prolong the types of questions that come out in some of these things. This is really just a contractual issue. We've talked about before, Pat, but just for if someone came into this episode, if you wonder what the delegation provision is, it's that many arbitration provisions delegate to the arbitrator not just issues before him or her, but also whether it can be arbitrated to begin with in those issues. And again, in my AAA function, sometimes there's challenges to whether or not something's arbitrable, and we have to decide those things within the arbitration provisions that are given to us. The oral arguments were very interesting in this case, and I again commend folks to check them out if you're interested at all in arbitration. This was a case again under the Federal Arbitration Act. The court also heard a case, Bissonnette versus LePage Bakeries, on another issue under the Federal Arbitration Act. The dispute here, as Pat mentioned, is over the delegation clause in an arbitration agreement, and that delegates to the arbitrator not only the job of resolving the dispute between the parties, but also threshold questions whether any particular dispute falls within the arbitrator's authority. Pat mentioned Bielski. The justices in that case, was an opinion written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, ordered the trial court to stay its proceedings pending the result of the what seems to be interminable litigation about whether this case should go to arbitration. The only issue here, and it's a pretty narrow one, but again, it has to do with this delegation and who gets to decide whether this should go to arbitration in the first place under this sweepstakes rules. Should it be the district court judge or should it be the arbitrator that's been assigned for this case? Coinbase, as Pat said, Coinbase prefers arbitration. They pointed to its user agreement. It says, again, it has a pretty broad and sweeping arbitration provision. It says that any disputes with Coinbase of any kind must be resolved by arbitration. And there's reasons for this, as we've talked about on previous shows, Pat. One is that in the arbitration setting, while there's some mass tort arbitration rules under AAA and other rules, the ability to bring multiple plaintiffs or claimants under one action is very limited, number one. Number two is that the rulings and orders and decisions of the arbitration body, whether it's AAA or other ones, is confidential. And so there's no precedential value of these cases, which can be a good thing. And in some cases, it might not, you know, in some cases, the company that's being sued may have preferred that these decisions come out, but that's the way it goes. The like I said, Coinbase points to its user agreement, and then the customers here in this case, in this dispute, point to the sweepstakes rules, which maybe by mistake or oversight, they fail to mention arbitration. And what they specifically talk about, and again, one of the things that happens in this situation, Pat, as we all know, is that many law firms often represent these big clients, and we get parachuted into whether it's defense or litigation or it's contractual things, and sometimes those different lawyers have different approaches to contract drafting. This the sweepstakes rules in this case, they specifically refer to California courts as being the venue. So again, whether that's a drafting error or some other mistake is brings one of the reasons why this litigation continues to ensue. The justices seem to be kind of all over the place. Neil Gorsuch got the customer's representative to concede that the arbitration agreement was still operative and that it says it applies to everything. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson looked at the facts differently. But what was interesting here, was that Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who again authored the last opinion, raised this question, and it may be dispositive, it may be an easy out for the justices in this case, as some have predicted. What he raised was the fact that the Ninth Circuit never raised the issue of whether or not the sweepstakes agreement superseded the actual other agreement between the parties. And so this one may go back to the district court and back up through the Ninth Circuit. I don't think this is going to be the last time the Supreme Court hears a Coinbase arbitration case. But that seemed, after Kavanaugh raised that question, Kagan and some others, I think, chimed in and agreed with that. So that may be the out for the justices here. But we'll see. It's an interesting question again. And again, whether it's Scrivener's error or was intentional in this case, because the sweepstakes are under a much more rigorous regime. And I don't recall, Pat, but in some cases there may be, I know California has very specific rigid rules on sweepstakes. I've done some sweepstakes works for clients. There may be some reasons under the sweepstakes regime and framework why it doesn't refer to arbitration, but I don't recall that being the case. So a lot of things to consider here. We'll see what the Supreme Court does with this. And, you know, to date, it hasn't issued an opinion. I think one of the good things for Pat and I, and Pat when he's looking at cases and posting on these cases, is the Supreme Court is probably the slowest of the bodies, even on cases where it agrees on. It's just way behind. It's only issued about two or three, about half a dozen now, substantive decisions this term, and has about 50 or so to issue before the term's over at the end of June.
Agreed. Similar to Justice Kavanaugh's question regarding, you know, maybe there's an easy out, Justice Thomas, I think, asked a very practical question. Did you guys look at this and see that there was this conflict? Couldn't somebody just have drafted this right so that, you know, it was clear which one was going to control? Was somebody asleep at the switch? It was more or less his question.
I think he's on to something. And again, that's, like I said earlier, the reality is that different counsel supports these clients in different ways, but someone's got to be the internal legal department, or somebody's got to be the gatekeeper for that kind of stuff to make sure there's consistencies, whether it's one transaction and multiple agreements, or it's like this, because otherwise, you know, you're going to get into the situation where a lot of confusion exists, and a lot of time's going to be spent on litigation over these topics.
That's exactly right. So with that, we will take our next break and come back with the Levenfeld case again.
Hey, Podiumin podcast listeners, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment 3 of episode 198 of the Podium and Panel podcast. Turning to our third case, what is the consequence of failing to follow Rule 1.5 by not obtaining a written disclosure of the contingency fee agreement? That is essentially the question to be answered when the Illinois Supreme Court decides Andrew W. Levenfeld and Associates Limited versus O'Brien. The defendants hired the plaintiffs to represent them in trust litigation and agreed to pay them 15% of the first $10 million recovered and 10% of any amount above that. The plaintiff worked on the matter for 19 months and then were terminated after the underlying defendants withdrew their offer. New counsel was engaged, and 2 months later, a near $17 million recovery was obtained in the underlying case. The defendants did not pay the plaintiffs the fee they claimed, and they sued. The matter proceeded to bench trial, where the circuit court entered an order finding that the original contingency fee agreement conformed with the value provided, even though the fee agreement itself was unenforceable, as it violated the rules of professional conduct. The circuit court, following trial on quantum merit and applying the factors, awarded the lawyers an amount equal to what they would have received had there been a valid agreement. The Illinois Appellate Court, First District, reversed in part and affirmed in part, and remanded the matter, stating, quote, "We reverse the trial court's decision that rendered a quantum merit award based on the terms of the underlying unenforceable contingency fee agreement, and affirm the trial court's determination that plaintiff's services provided a benefit to defendants. We remand this matter to the trial court to render a quantum merit award based on the relevant factors involved in determining the reasonable value of the services rendered," end quote. Pat, tell us about this interesting case that involves lawyers of all kinds.
Thanks, Dan. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, the argument in this case took place before a live audience at Northern Illinois University.
700 people in attendance.
Exactly, yeah. 700 people, which, and I communicated with one of the advocates, and he's just, it was unlike anything he had really experienced before. Usually an appellate advocate doesn't have an audience.
No.
And this one, they had an audience, and they weren't the, there were two cases that were argued, and there apparently was, during the argument, there was audible response to some of the arguments that were being made, that kind of, oh, okay, well, the audience likes that one. Do I play to the crowd? I mean, the crowd you paying for is the seven people in front of you, not the 700 people behind you.
But, yeah, one of the cases I understand was criminal, and then there was this civil case.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing is at one point in the argument, Justice Tice took kind of control of the proceedings about 10 minutes or so in, maybe longer, to try to explain. It was plain what she was, at least it seemed to me, what she was trying to do was to explain to the audience what the hell they were talking about. Because as you can imagine, you've got two advocates who have, you know, lived with this case, in this case for a very long time. And you've got seven justices who have read all the briefs. They know what's going on. They kind of jump right into the issues. It doesn't really frame things for people who are not only ignorant of this case, but probably not really clued into what the issues are they're talking about. So she felt it necessary to take a minute to kind of explain what this case was about, because the court was, and this was across, I mean, I think all the justices asked a question at one point or another, which is a bit unusual for this court. And Justice Cunningham, who is one that frequently asks questions, was really disturbed by this situation, where these lawyers had, and to this day still have not, agreed on what the split is. And she's like, well, we have this rule. And if there's no punishment for failing to abide by this rule, what is the purpose of the rule? The rule should be followed. What are we doing here? And she asked that question, and others asked questions of a similar line in that same vein. What are we doing here if you're not going to follow the rule? And then the questions came, okay, so what's the damage to your client as a result of this damage? Or a result of this, I'm sorry, failure to, what is the damage as a result of the failure to follow this rule? She says, well, they don't know the split. Maybe they wouldn't have agreed to it. I don't know. That's the whole point. And then we have, a whole range of issues regarding damages and whether there were damages, how you, and whether there was any, that is, these lawyers did work for 19 months, and the argument of the defendants is that they did that work and achieved no tangible benefit, that they're not entitled to quantum merit because they didn't achieve anything, because by the time they were fired, there were no offers on the table. And then there was a flat fee arrangement that was entered into with a subsequent lawyer who was able to get the matter resolved for more than what the plaintiffs had achieved, but as pointed out by the plaintiff's lawyer, that included it may not have been more because of the amount of money that had to be paid for the house or amount of money that had to be paid to keep the house, so that there may have been more value in what the plaintiffs had negotiated than what subsequent counsel negotiated. But that really doesn't answer the question of, well, the time you were fired, there were no offers. So maybe they did provide value. I think the court plainly agrees that reference to the contingency of fee amount as the basis to calculate the quantum merit was improper by the trial court. The question is how to do this in this circumstance. It's the position of the defendants that are not entitled to anything. But a very interesting case about what do you do when the rules aren't followed? Is there a remedy for the other side? And what purpose are the rules serving in a circumstance like this? Because the rules are plainly, and this one in particular, is plainly designed to protect a client. That's the whole, its whole purpose. And here it wasn't abided by, yet it doesn't seem the defendants, or strike that the plaintiffs, have suffered any or will suffer any damage as a result if the trial court's opinion stands. Dan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, these cases are tough, Pat, because on contingency fee, I mean, you and I don't work on contingency fee, or at least often. I mean, I worked on one a couple of years ago, and you invest a lot of time and energy, and if it doesn't pop, then you are out the money, right? There's
right.
And in this
and
case,
the opportunity cost of the other things you could have done.
Right. And in a case like this where, you know, there hadn't been any tangible benefit, although shortly after, a number that was pretty close to what they had originally had on the table was out there. So it's these cases are tough. Do you know, Pat, why this was a violation of the rules of professional conduct? Was it because it wasn't fully disclosed adequately? The arrangement?
They didn't, the split between, part of what has to be split, or part of what has to be disclosed and in writing in the agreement is
any split that you're giving to other attorneys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The disclosure was made that the two attorneys would work on the matter, which has to be disclosed. But also what the split is, and that's what wasn't done. Now, there was an argument made that it didn't have to be written. Let's just say the court wasn't buying that argument.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be an argument that's gonna carry the day, but it that's what has to be written is that one lawyer gets one third of the one third fee and the other lawyer gets the remaining two thirds or whatever it happened to be. The point is, in this case, the lawyers still haven't agreed. To this day, they haven't agreed as to what the split is.
Yeah,
and that's pretty. And so the question is, would the client agree to it? Because if all the lawyer is doing is making the referral, which is unclear what happened here.
Yeah.
But if all they're doing is making the referral, then the amount of their fee should be substantially less. So.
Yeah, and that's you raise an interesting point. I was going to raise is that for again listeners that aren't familiar with this, oftentimes Pat and I don't do personal injury, we don't do medical malpractice, we don't do probate, we don't do a lot of different things, and there's rules on some things you cannot split fees on or get a referral fee for, and I don't know the full list of those, but there are certain areas of law where you can't get referral fees. But in any event, oftentimes what happens is a lawyer, we have friends, family, colleagues, everybody will say, hey, Pat, do you know anybody that can help me with XYZ, you know, and then what happens in those cases, and as Pat mentioned, if you're just purely referral, that's got to be disclosed, but it's often a smaller amount if for those that do that kind of referral work. It could be a very small dollar.
Oftentimes it's a third of a third.
A third of a third. And even sometimes it's less than that, because again, if you're just a referring attorney, you know, there's rules about professional conduct and who's working the case and, you know, do you have the competency? If it's, you know, if it's a workers' comp case, I wouldn't know what in the hell to do.
Yeah, you know, if you didn't do anything other than say, hey, call Joe Blow, he's a good lawyer, talk to him.
Right.
And I've had situations where that's happened, and they've said, you know, what's your referral fee? I said, I don't have a referral fee. Just do a good job for my friend. I'm not interested. I don't want to get into that mess.
Well, and a lot of It also creates, it can create some real conflicts, and so there are firms I've been at in the past that are just absolutely, you cannot get a referral fee for those conflict reasons as well as anything else, right? You don't want to have the appearance later that plaintiff's firm is against you, depending on what kind of work you do.
Or the carrier or the defendant on the other side, they now find out that you're taking a piece of the fee
right.
that was against them. Can you imagine how that's going to go?
Yeah.
And if it's money you recover from your practice of law, which it is, you got to share it with your partners, which means you have to disclose it to your partners.
Right.
So they get a piece of the action, and then they may find out what you did, and they may not like it, and then it becomes a big mess. I just don't is it worth it? Just do a good job. I don't want any part of the money.
Right.
I don't need the money. I don't want it. It's not worth the headache.
It's not worth it. No.
It's just not.
Nope.
So I say that, and then if I get some case where it's a quad, I may change my tune. Of course, then I right. have to work.
If it was a jumbo case, you might be like, okay, well.
I may change my policy. Or
yeah.
change my practice, too, if right. that case comes across my desk.
Right.
So.
You may go to the dark side if it was big enough.
Exactly. I may right. find a way to.
I can help you litigate this case.
Exactly. I can handle this. We get a line of credit and litigate this thing. So anyway, an interesting case and an important case for the law,
it is.
The law of lawyering is where this case is really important.
And it's interesting because, like I said, we were at the Appellate Lawyers Association Supreme Court Justice Roundtable. I was at Justice Overstreet's table, and he talked about the oral arguments. He talked about people were asking him, you know, what were the cases involved? Was the audience interested? He said, you know, this, and he mentioned what you said, is that this is, you know, kind of a technical case, but for lawyers, a very important case. And so one of the things that happens in these, when they go on tour, and they used to do this before COVID a little bit, but not as much as Indiana Supreme Court that really goes on the road show every year. But in any event, he said that what happens after these things is that there's a panel discussion of these cases. The students and others that are in attendance, especially the students at colleges and high schools and law schools, they might have assignments, but there's kind of a discussion of what the cases were. They get the cases ahead of time, like brief summaries of what the cases are. And then there's this, while the justices are having their conference right after the cases and doing their initial vote, the audience is kind of getting some more education and talking about what they saw. And so it's a good educational experience. I know, Pat, you've gone to the Indiana Supreme Court once when it's been at Purdue and other places. So it's a nice way to make the court more accessible to the public and to see what the process looks like.
The closest experience I had to this was years ago. I had an oral argument before then Judge Mikva, now Justice Mikva, but it was a Judge Mikva at the time. And there were about 20 or so law students from China that were visiting, and they had come to her courtroom to observe. And so we had the case, opposing counsel and I, judge says, all right, explain to, you know, what's this case is going to be about before we have the oral argument. So neither one of us were quite ready for this. And so we didn't know this was what was going to happen. And so we turn around and say, this is who I represent. This is what the case is about. And just try to explain. And then we had our argument in front of Judge Mikva, but it was that was the closest I've gone where we had an audience where we had to explain what was going on first.
No. So.
So with that, that brings us to our BIPA, BI, GIPA, IPA. Nothing really this week, but next week we're going to talk about the oral argument before the California Supreme Court on their BI for COVID situation. So that look forward to that for next week. So that's our preview of coming attractions.
And my Federation of Regulatory Counsel IPAs are brewing in Illinois. Was published last week. So talks mostly about the Genetic Information Privacy Act. And I think we've talked about it on the show before that life insurers are facing suits under that. There's been talk that it could be modified, which would be a game changer for underwriting life insurance if it passed, because how else do you differentiate people other than their genetic backgrounds and whether they have major diseases in their background? Anyway.
Indeed. So that brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong for this week. A good week, Dan. 4-0.
It's a big week. One of the biggest weeks we've ever had.
Yeah, 4-0.
Don't mess with us.
Yes, exactly. Progressive versus Lonsdale from episode 192 from the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District. This dealt with a stay of whether it was proper to stay a coverage case pending the outcome of an underlying tort case, and the court affirmed. The lesson here is have a transcript of the ruling of the court, even if it's on a de novo review, because in this case, they didn't have it, so they didn't have the transcript, and they didn't have a bystander's report either, so they weren't able to show the court, the appellate court, that the trial court had misapplied the law, because they didn't know what law the court had applied. And so they couldn't make an abuse. They couldn't make a de novo argument. Couldn't really make a de novo argument because they didn't have the record. And they couldn't make an abuse of discretion argument because they didn't have the record. Bottom line, go get the record. I don't know if it would have changed the outcome, but that's the lesson from this case. Dan, anything to add on Lonsdale?
No, I think that's right. And as we've talked about, just procedurally, another tip for the practitioner, you know, yeah, have the record, right? Order it. Don't be cheap because it's cost a few bucks or whatever the case, whatever reason you didn't get it, get the record.
Which brings us to Schultz versus Synav. This is the one I referenced earlier, a tidy 56-page opinion. We only addressed one of the issues on episode 194. Dan, why don't you tell us about this case?
Sure, Pat. And this was a case that had to do with a merger and an LLC and one very majority owner and cash out merger. And rights being assessed. As you said, it's a 56-page opinion that goes into great detail, although it says it's going to give a very short overview, and then the overview, I think, goes on for about 8 or 10 pages at least of the history of this case and facts. And again, commend it to you for those that are in the M&A space, whether you litigate it or not, very important issues that are being addressed here with respect, again, to cash out mergers and the duties that arise to minority shareholders. This is a case that had to do with ethanol in a class action, but in part and parcel of this merger that took place. And so, like I said, the panel right at the outset, so this is a very, very complex case, very technical in scope. And so, once again, it's important for those that draft and advise on corporate structures. You know, we talk about some of these corporate issues. Pat, last week we talked about registered agents in Cook County and those decisions that are made. I had a call on Friday with a client just talking about structures and domiciles and all kinds of things on Friday versus sole proprietorships. So a lot of issues come into play in these things. And like in the Coinbase case, I think part of what's important to keep in mind here for the scriveners is to very clearly and make sure that you set forth in the operating agreement and governing documents and in the transaction documents very clear definitions and make it clear who gets what and how decisions are made so that you don't get into these complex disputes.
Indeed, which brings us to In Re Recalled Abbott Infant Formula Products Liability Litigation, Appeal of Economic Loss Plaintiffs, a tidy little name.
Yeah, circuit. Rolls off the tongue.
It rolls right off the tongue. We discussed on episode 191, this is a case, the Seventh Circuit's hobby horse of standing, that if you recall the this facility that makes baby formula up in Sturgis, Michigan, had some real problems with contamination, and folks sued. There are several classes within this group, this economic loss class that claims that they suffered damages as a result of the misrepresentation on one hand or the unfairness on the other, and the court held that they did not have standing because they couldn't trace that any particular plaintiff had any particular damage or had the formula that they purchased contaminated. So the court affirmed the trial court's dismissal based on standing of that class of the plaintiffs. There's other classes still remaining, just not these classes. Which brings us to Safeco versus Blue Sky for episode 183 of the Podium and Panel podcast. This was from the Indiana Supreme Court. The court declined to expand third-party spoliation claims to include a party where there wasn't a direct agreement to create a special relationship to preserve items from a fire. Dan, anything to add on either of those two cases?
Nope.
Okay, so that brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong this week. And we have only two because, as we said, the Reinhardt case was decided before we talked about it. Coinbase versus Suskey. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, like I said, I think they're going to send it back on this issue that I mentioned that Kavanaugh raised, and it seemed to be some coalition around it of whether or not the sweepstakes agreement superseded the underlying agreement.
So it's not us that are punting, it's they that are going to punt?
I think they will punt in this case. I think so.
Okay. All right. And then Levenfeld. I think this gets affirmed.
I think it gets affirmed, yep.
Now, there's a cross appeal in this case. I don't know how well the cross appeal is going to do. I don't think they were down for giving these people nothing, even though I get the argument that they are in a tie. But I think we'll just say that it gets affirmed.
I think it gets affirmed.
The trial court needs to go back and do it again.
Yep.
The trial court does without the benefit of the contingency fee arrangement, which brings us to the rule of the week. Dan, why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. As I mentioned a couple times now, the Appellate Lawyers Association had its annual Supreme Court Justices Roundtable, and at that, Chief Justice Tice gives remarks. She noted that the ALA is mostly comprised of civil appellate attorneys, but she raised some interesting issues, Pat, and one of the reasons that we may be getting opinions much quicker is that the so-called Safety Act, which she made clear doesn't have the word Safety Act in it, there's no such reference in the act, and that she's said that the courts have been trying to get people to use the public law numbers, but to no avail. The Safety Act's been used. This is the conviction bail pre-trial detention. She talked about the fact that these cases they're all being appealed, and that like 58% of the Fifth District appeals are on these pre-petition cases, the bond cases. What she commended all of us, Pat, is that on the front page of the Illinois Supreme Court, they have a page that's dedicated to all the various issues that are arising. And a couple of things that are happening that civil litigators should be paying attention to. One is a lot of precedent is being created on interlocutory appeals, because those are all interlocutory appeals. There's a lot of talk about standards of review, whether it's de novo, abuse of discretion, as you talked about earlier, preponderance. And so she said, even though these are criminal cases, that practitioners in the civil arena should be paying attention for potential changes and potential impacts on the civil arena. She did mention that many of the civil cases, at least for oral argument purposes, are being delayed because, again, these interlocutory appeals have to be conducted in 14 days. And very fact-intensive, very huge amount of work for these for the districts to produce these opinions, and that the Supreme Court docket's also being very much impacted because of all these appeals that then go up from the appellate courts and interlocutory to the Supreme Court. So something to commend to, again, civil. She mentioned, again, the LA. I happen to have one criminal defense attorney, appellate lawyer at my table, and she talked about some of the challenges, not just on these cases, but in general. And so I think it's important for practitioners that probably listen to our podcast, again, to keep in mind that what she said was that the court is making presidential rulings on interlocutory appeals and on standards of review that may bleed over into the civil arena. And so that's, at a minimum, somebody should be tracking and paying attention to what's going on for impact. And again, if you have civil appeals that you're filing for oral arguments, she noted again that they may be delayed because these criminal cases have to be conducted and heard within the very tight timelines. She did mention that she thought that maybe the legislature might change some of the rulings. There was talk at our table post about whether or not that every one of these had to be heard and appealed, or if there'd be some kind of standards. Judge Moltz, who was at my table, mentioned one case where he had to decide these issues, and in that case, the individual had been convicted 26 times, I think it was, of priors. He said there was no way that this person was getting out on pre-petition, and so he was advocating, I think, for some sort of threshold to get these cases, to make these decisions at the appellate level. So, it just interesting facts. Pat and I cover civil cases pretty much exclusively, although occasionally we do qualified immunity or something else, but. Just something to commend to you if you're not paying attention at all to what's going on in that arena.
I don't need more to read. I appreciate Justice Tice's recommendation. Good Lord, if I have to read the criminal cases too, I'm going to pull my hair out. Someone else needs to do that.
Yeah. I agree. I agree.
I mean, I appreciate the suggestion, but good Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them, as she said, yeah. You know. But they've cataloged them on the front page by topic and by issues addressed. Okay. But again, there's thousands of them, so good luck navigating good luck that indeed. Stuff.
All right. With that helpful note, helpful, yes. Depressing that there's more to read. With that, we'll take our leave. We'll see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.